watching Dr. Dobbs TechCast.
Okay, so why are you guys all here? Why does everybody come to this talk instead of to my good talks? What's going on here? Are you train wreck fans? No. The information here is valuable. I'm a little bit reluctant, actually, to present it all in one piece, because then you tend to concentrate on what's wrong with C++ instead of how to use it properly. It's a very fine line. How many people have heard of patterns and anti-patterns? How many people agree with me that anti-patterns, the concept of anti-patterns, is the work of Satan? Okay, we have some agreement here, not very much. Ah, well, there you go. Good. If you don't know about anti-patterns, that's fine. An anti-pattern is basically, well, what's a pattern? It shows in one sentence. Now, I'll get in trouble with all the patterns wonks. A right way of doing something that can be context, that can be customized according to the context to be reused. An anti-pattern is basically a wrong way of doing things that can be customized to various other contexts and misused in many different contexts. The idea is that if you recognize an anti-pattern, you'll avoid it. But there's a subtle problem here. What you'd like to do is have this subconscious recall of the correct situation where the context requires a certain technique. You do not want to have an unconscious recall of thinking, oh, here's a brand new design situation. I can't do it this way, I can't do it that way, I can't do it this way. That's useless. So you want to be able to recognize a bad technique, but you don't want it to be right front and center when you go to do a design. Same thing for these gotchas. In a sense, I'm a little worried about placing them all together like this. Typically, they're sprinkled throughout another talk. You know, every other page or so, you might see a little gotcha. So this is kind of dangerous. The idea is to recognize these things without actually endorsing them somehow, either consciously or subconsciously. How many people are here from the Java community who just want more ammunition against C++? I have some ammunition against Java, too. Just details on request. This used to be a two-day talk. I found out that people would run screaming from the room after about 3 hours, so this is now an hour-and-a-half talk. And, of course, this is just a subset of all the horrible things that you can do with C++. And this year I've decided to concentrate on very low-level issues. Okay, we have a reasonably sized group here. We all seem to be under 6 feet or so. No. So feel free to interrupt with questions. We don't have to wait till the question and answer period. If you have really, really strong opinions, keep your mouth shut, and we'll be better. No, feel free to interrupt. First of all, let's go on to the you should know better section. This is something I've been improving on as the years go by. I get more curmudgeonly all the time. These are things we know we shouldn't do, and we do them anyway. It's kind of like drinking coffee to excess or doing even worse things. Okay, so we still do these things. So I'd just like to remind you of these faults. How many people still use magic numbers? And I'm not talking about Unix file things. Yeah. What? You can't help yourself, right? Is there anything else you do you want to admit to? Yeah, what's wrong with doing this? I have a portfolio of some sort of set of contracts. And, well, it's bad design to start with, right? But suppose I was forced into this. And I have an array of 10 contracts, and I have a portfolio ID number, which is also 10 characters. Is there anything wrong with this? Yeah, everything's wrong with it. What does 10 mean to you? Well, it's a number of digits, you know, things like that. What happens if I change the number of contracts or change the length of an ID? Well, I'll change them both, probably, because if you're like me, you like to use Ed as your editor, and you do a global change. And remember Ed? Yeah. It works. Okay, so magic numbers like this are a definite bad idea. And it's silly. There's no reason we should do this. We should be using some sort of manifest constant. We're not interested in the fact that there are 10 contracts, but there is a fixed number of contracts like maximum number of contracts or ID length or something like that. We want to have these constants have some sort of abstraction associated with them. Everything's an abstraction, right? Reality is an abstraction. Just trying to see if anybody's awake out there. Yeah, so we have functions that are abstractions. We have data types that are abstractions. Abstract data types are abstractions of sets of operations. Functions are abstractions of operations. Variables are abstractions of some sort of abstract set of operations. So are our constants. So this simply using 10 doesn't help us here. There's another problem in C++. When you finally get around to saying, okay, I'll use a defined constant, max port 10. What's wrong with this? What's wrong with saying pound define? It's not type safe, yeah. This one, I happen to know the type of this. This is 10. 10 is an int. Now I don't know, what's the type of max port now?
Wrong.
Maybe. You've been programming a Win16? You can admit it. We're all friends here.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. So this could be a long, could be an int. Okay, in C++, that makes a big difference. There's a worse problem. Remember namespaces? This doesn't respect namespaces. There's no respect for anything, actually. I define maxport, and it is in existence until the end of the translation unit. It doesn't know about scopes. It doesn't know about namespaces. It's simply waiting to cause some sort of problem. Not only that, but it's often a good idea to be able to go back and forth between a constant and a non-constant. Okay, what's wrong with this? Well, same thing, right? I'm defining debug to be true. Then if I have code like this, if debug, suppose I have, how many people here admit it? If def, they're debugging code. You almost have to, right? It's traditional. We've been doing it for years, therefore it's correct. Wrong. If you do that, you have two programs to maintain. You have your debugging version and your non-debugging version. You have to compile your code twice to determine whether your code is syntactically correct. And the trouble is with debugging flags is they tend to multiply. They undergo this kind of strange mitosis over the years. Or is it meiosis? Is anybody biologically inclined here? That's not a personal question. That's so you end up with, you start off with yes, no, I'm debugging, I'm not. Then you have debugging levels. Then you have different debugging flags. The erroneous something debugging flag and so on. And eventually you have 12 or 14 flags, each of which has three different values. And then to actually determine if your code is syntactically correct will take some exponential number of compilations or maybe some large polynomial, I don't know, but it's big. What do? Just say no. Okay. Just say no to pound define debugging flags. What you might want to do is just say, okay, I'll define debug to be a Boolean. Okay, so when I'm debugging, that's fine. What's wrong with that? Well, I'll be able to turn the debugging code on and off. So that's good. What's wrong with it?
Anybody else can too.
Well, not necessarily. I mean,
when it's all, you have to resolve the expression, for example.
Yeah, yep. And not only that, but this code's going to remain in your source file, right? Well, what if I do this? Is that okay? Well, it'll get rid of the if statement, so it'll take away this conditional code, but I'll still have this code present in my object file. Well, what if I do this? Okay, now which code am I going to remove? All of it. Okay, so if debug is false, that's a compile time constant. The compiler has to be able to evaluate that expression, and it will do this code elimination. So what you're going to get is a full parse and a full static semantic check of your debugging code, but the code will be eliminated from your object code. I've been doing this for decades, and well, almost decades, 12 years. And I thought I was the only person who did this sort of thing. And then Kernahan and Pike came out with a book, a wonderful book if you're over the age of 40, that complains about young programmers these days, et cetera, et cetera. And they mentioned this technique as a good alternative to conditional code, to ifdefs. Now, we're all adults here, right? We know there's going to be some sort of ifdef in our code, but we try to minimize them to the extent possible. This is one technique we can use. Now, clearly, there will be an ifdef somewhere because it will probably define the initialization of this debugging flag with a compile line minus D or whatever. Okay, so there will be some minimal ifdef, but most of the code should be written this way.
What's the advantage of that over if?
This is a single program, whereas if you have an ifdef, you have two different programs. What the compiler sees is two different source sequences of tokens. Whereas here, the compiler will see the same sequence of tokens in either case, but so it will do everything up to runtime evaluation of this, but it'll do the code elimination for you as well. Okay, so you get all the advantages of an ifdef plus a lot more safety.
Is there nothing about optimization implementation in that? Is it mandated that an optimizer will do that with the
cons? No, I don't believe so. Not in the language specification itself. But every compiler I know of will do this, and even more. The compiler has to be able to evaluate this expression at compile time. It's required for other features of the language. And if you don't have minus G set, then I have never seen a compiler that wouldn't do that code elimination because it's trivial to do. But no, it's not specified in the standard. Comments. All right, I know you don't want to hear about comments. How many people think that comments are a good idea? Well, I disagree with you. I try to eliminate comments to the extent possible. Comments are actively damaging to the meaning and understanding and maintenance of your program. Let me rephrase that. Too many comments are damaging. You should try to minimize the number of comments in your code. Now, the minimal amount could be a very large amount if you have a very complex piece of code. But in general, people tend to over-comment, and comments don't tend to be maintained. And if you have voluminous comments, they tend not to be read. Some examples. Now, very few people are going to write the first comment, assign B to A. Most people will write assign A to B. Why do they do that? I have no idea. Okay, so they'll write, if you write assign B to A, well, what good is that comment? None. Absolutely none. It is actively damaging because it won't be maintained. This is an actual real-world example. I looked at this code. I read the comment. I'm one of the guys who reads comments. And I thought to myself, subtle piece of code. C must be a reference to A. No. Therefore, very subtle comment. If I assign B to C, later on, execution will be changed in some way so that I will do the same assignment to A. Half an hour later? No, it's just a bad comment. This wasted half an hour of my time. Okay, it was an actively damaging comment. Never comment anything that you can write more clearly in the code itself. Any comment that can be gotten rid of should be. What's wrong with saying public interface? Yeah, it says public right there. If you don't know what a default constructor is, a comment is not going to help you. If you've been programming in COBOL and you need these comments, well, you know, I sell C++ courses. Okay, so these types of comments are very, very damaging, and of course, they're not maintained either, and they tend to cause more problems than they solve. Another example, nobody really cares that you fix the bug. You may be very proud of yourself, but putting bug fix comments in the code is not really going to help anybody understand the program as it is. Does anybody still put change logs in their files? Why? Why did you do that? Somebody forcing you? Oh, gee. Yeah, you know, they sell programs to keep track of things like that for you. You can buy them. Okay. Is he my age or older? Okay. I don't know what to say. You can have him give me a call. There's always the HR solution to things like this. How how long lived did these change logs? I mean, do they go to many, many pages?
In some files, they get truncated after a major release that was never going back to. So, the worst case is probably 10 pages worth in a really bad file. Of course, my intention is that things have been rewritten, but I don't think that matters.
No, we don't rewrite code anymore. We refactor it. Well, I've never really seen a set of change logs that really did anything for me, except maybe point out a project in trouble. And when you see this, you see certain dates and you get large volumes of changes in a short period of time, it implies either, chemically assisted programming or some sort of problem.
We have a number of programs that are older than most people. And every so often, some of them are used just once in a while, but when they are used, they're needed. Every so often, you'll get a call from a user, how come this doesn't work anymore? That's, for that purpose, change logs are occasionally useful.
Yeah. Well, be that as it may, I've put my comments and comments out there, especially ones in change logs. The other thing that's very important is we don't comment code like this. Printf, hello. Would I comment this code? Would I have a comment saying print hello to standard output? What's good about the standard library in C++? Don't say nothing. Well, one thing is, if I want to swap a pair of values, if I want to sort a sequence, if I want to find something in a sequence, whatever, that's all part of the standard library, and I don't have to comment that code. So now, when I use a sort, or when I write a function that consists of a sort and a bunch of binary searches or something like that, if I'm using standard library containers and algorithms, those are some comments I don't have to write. You don't have to, and you shouldn't write comments for code like that. You might want to write a comment on the intent of the function. What is this function doing? But you don't have to comment how it's doing it. Because we know that when you call sort, guess what happens? Yep. Okay. Remember, this is the section about the problems we all know about. Global variables. Does anybody still use global variables? No, I'm not going to... All right, never mind. Forget I asked. They're really complex. They make code very, very difficult to reuse. Especially if you're doing a lot of multi-threading and you have a lot of global variables, you probably know it's not a good idea. So, and there are so many different alternatives to using global variables, there really is no excuse anymore for having any globals. Now, static variables I also dislike and I try to minimize, but at least they are not accessible by everybody on the planet, or everybody in the process, in any case. Here's an example. This is a real-life example. We were trading derivative securities, and we were promised by our management managers. How many of you are there here? Okay. Two people you have to watch out for. You know about managers, right? Okay. Summer interns. Any summer interns? Okay, they're dangerous for different reasons. The managers are dangerous because they have power and no knowledge. The summer interns are dangerous because they have skill but no restraint. Okay, these are two dangerous combinations of abilities. Okay, so the management said, all right, there's only going to be one pricing environment. One. There'll never be more than one. You can bet your boots that everybody's going to use the same pricing environment for these securities. What happened 2 weeks before release? Multiple environments for pricing. The trader's environment and the official environment. This global variable that pointed to the one and only environment appeared all throughout about 900,000 lines of code. And it had to be changed. How long did the change take? 6 staff months. Okay, there were 60 people on the project, so it was much faster, but it took 6 months of people time. What if we had done something very simple like this? I mean, at least wrap it up in a function. Now we could have changed it in 6 staff minutes. We could have overloaded the function, we could have given it a default argument initializer, and recompiled. Okay, so there really is no excuse for having global variables anymore, if there ever was. Inline functions solve any sort of problems with efficiency you might be worried about. We also have lots of techniques like our singleton pattern, which tells you how to create a single environment in a safe way, and so on. So there really is no need for global variables. And actually, static variables in general are overused. You could probably get by with at most one per program. You probably rarely need more than that, if that. Does anybody disagree with this? Okay. Uninitialized variables. Second largest cause of bugs in KNRC programs. The biggest cause of bugs was formal argument mismatches, formal actual argument mismatches. Now that we have static type checking for function calls, you would expect that uninitialized variables would be the largest source of bugs, and typically it is. So what do we do? Why do we initialize variables? Well, so they'll be initialized, they'll be in a good state. But another way to think about it, I'm just erasing the board to save time here. Another way to think about it is you don't want to have a variable hanging around with nothing to do. You'd like every variable to be working all the time and be always valid. You'd like to restrict the definition, the scope of a variable, to its scope of use. You'd like those things to coincide exactly. What happens otherwise? Well, it's kind of like teenagers or something, you know, after school. I mean, they're sitting there waiting to cause problems, right? So basically, they should be killed after school. But, or, you know, put to work doing something else. There's a strange tendency. If I have in some function, like my favorite function f, a variable which I will choose to call x star. Did I mention I'm on drugs right now? So if I start to wander off, just, okay. Suppose I have a pointer to an x. Okay, fine. I should probably initialize it. What if I don't have a good initial value for that pointer? Should I initialize it to null? No, of course not. I'm just not going to declare it until I have a use for it. I'm going to wait. C++ makes it easy to wait until I have the required information to declare the variable. So I can simply delay declaration until I have a valid initializer, and that's good. What about when I'm finished using the variable? Say I use it in this section of code. Is there any runtime cost for keeping this variable around? Not really. But what's going to happen? Enter the summer student. Summer student says, well, I need a pointer to an x. And this x is it's actually a money. This is a pointer to some money. My value. No, bond value. The value of the bond. Okay. So this is a pointer to the bond value. Now, later in the same function, I want to price an equity. do I declare money star equity value? Certainly not. I am a summer student, so I will simply use bond value for equity value for the rest of the function. How easy is this going to be to maintain? It's absolutely impossible. It even makes a lot of sense to artificially introduce a block to make this pointer die when time is coming. I mean, you don't want to have artificial life support for these variables. So anything you can do to restrict a variable to the scope of its use will save you an enormous number of bugs. There's a nice new feature in C++ that lets you declare a variable in a condition. The scope of the variable is the statements controlled by the condition. So NP is in scope both in the if part and in the else part, although it has limited use in the else part since you happen to know it's going to be null. But nevertheless, this restricts NP to the scope of its use, and this is actually quite a nice feature. Yes?
How much overhead can you introduce by throwing in those scope brackets
everywhere? None. As a matter of fact, you might even say, your stack frame might be slightly smaller. It depends how your compiler lays out its stack frames. If you're in embedded systems, you might care very much how your compiler lays it out, but this will certainly cost you zero. It can only improve things, actually. Yep.
In that example under the second word advice, if name asterisk NP, what is the scope of NP in there?
NP, the scope of NP is from the point of its declaration, which is right here, just before its initializer, up through this entire statement. So it's in scope here. After that, it goes away.
I've only seen scopes in curly braces before, so I've got a scope within parentheses. So,
that's right.
So is it a general rule that it's difficult in the statement until the next semicolon? What is the rule there?
The rule in this case is a special rule for the conditional for the if, and it simply says it's in scope in the condition after the point of declaration, before it's initialized, and in the statements controlled by the condition. So for the if, whether it's a block or a single statement, and also for the else part. Now, there are a different set of rules for temporary lifetimes, which I believe we're going to talk about later. So you want to say if name np equals what?
Well, normally, most of our declare an initialized value statements are written like a constructor instead of like an equal.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Or temporary. That would be legal there?
You know, strangely enough, I have never tried that, but there's no reason it shouldn't be legal. So if you're using any compiler but Microsoft, it'll probably work fine. No, I don't know. I'm sorry. That was not warranted. I'm sorry. That was a low blow.
Is that in Visual C++?
No, it's not. This is not work yet. It doesn't work on my Visual C++. I don't have service patch 96,526 yet, so I don't know.
Yeah, 6.0.
Yeah, 6.0. It does not work in my version of 6.0 with service patch 3? I don't know. Whatever. Anyway, so it doesn't work, but it should, and it will someday, because it's very, very easy to do. Unless they're going to, I don't know, do we have to program C sharp now? Is that it? Okay, the point is, make sure your variables are always working or else are dead. Okay, totalitarianism is a good thing in object-oriented design. Okay, syntax problems. These are very minor problems that nevertheless keep you late at your terminals. Each one of these things has caused me problems over my life. Okay, how many precedence levels does C++ have? I keep losing track. Lots. Many, many levels of precedence. I thought there were 17, and Stan Lippman said there were 18, and I just lost track. And actually, I think it depends on how you write the grammar for the language and so on. Does everybody know that C++ is an inherently ambiguous language? It's not you, it's the language, okay? Yeah, that's true. At certain points, the compiler has to say, I don't know what this is. I guess it's a declaration. Okay. Remember the old advice, parenthesize when you're not sure. Sometimes it's even a good idea to parenthesize when you are sure if somebody else might not be sure. For example, shift operators, relatively low precedence. And as a matter of fact, they are lower precedence, but they are higher precedence. See, I'm getting it wrong already. They are higher precedence than assignment. So if I want to print out the value of A and I want to assign B to A first, I might be tempted to write this first statement. But of course, I'm going to print out the previous value of A, well, if I get that far, and then I will attempt to assign B to what? A reference to an output stream. Will it work? I don't think so. I mean, a lot of stuff works in IO stream that you wouldn't expect, but I don't believe this will work. Okay, what about this one? Now, this might work. I'm not sure, actually. Here, I want to print the larger of A and B, the lesser of A and B, but I forgot to parenthesize my question mark colon expression. So what do I get? I'm going to print out either true or false, and based on whether the output stream is still in a good state or not, after having printed out that truth value, I will make the entire value of the expression either A or B. Okay, probably not what you expected. Has anybody seen Unix code from Berkeley written in the 70s? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. Talk about creative use of question mark colon. It's something to avoid. It's kind of a macho coding style that really doesn't do anybody any favors. Pointer to members. How many people have experienced the pleasure of using pointers to class members? They're a real pain in the neck, right? Some of us like them, but you know, we don't really have any other, you know, no social life to speak of. So they are useful, but we tend to hide them where we can, simply because a lot of people have trouble dealing with them. And they're with good reason. They're very difficult to use properly. So here, I have a pointer to a member function, and I'm trying to dereference that pointer to member function with a pointer to a class. Unfortunately, this operator, arrow star, is an operator. It is not an arrow followed by a star. It's the arrow star operator. Sounds like a minivan, but it's not. It's an operator. And it has a relatively low precedence, far lower than the function call operator. So in fact, what I'm doing here is I'm trying to call a pointer to a member function and then somehow dereference it and call it again. It's not going to work. I have to parenthesize this expression. I have to dereference the pointer to member and then call the function. Okay. What's even worse might be something like the second example. Suppose I have a pointer to a data member of a class. Now, a pointer to a data member is just an offset into the class, most probably. Here, I am dereferencing that pointer to a data member, and I want to increment that integer. That's what I intended, but what did I actually write? Okay, here's a class layout of some sort. And maybe I have an integer data member inside that class at this particular offset. Okay, so my pointer to data member basically is the offset, something like an offset into the class. When I dereference it with that pointer, well, CP is going to point to the start of the class. I'm going to add the offset, and that will give me this integer data member. So what I wanted to do was take this 12 and increment it to be 13. What did I actually do here? Well, I incremented the pointer to point down here. Then I'm going to access this non-existent data member and increment it. It's legal. It's not moral, but it's legal. Okay, so I probably should have parenthesized the dereference expression. Okay, very, very common source of bugs. And pointers to data members are hard enough that bugs like this can make them almost impossible to use. So parenthesize every which way when you're using pointers to members. Okay, here's an example of an inherent ambiguity in C++. Here I have three strings, I thought. I'm declaring one, initializing it to semantics. I have a default initialization of T, and what is X? I should take the comments out of here. These comments aren't necessary, right? Yeah, I've declared a function that takes no arguments and returns a string. Most people get hit with this a few times. I got hit with it last month. It took me forever. You forget. You write such good code most of the time that then you forget, and this sneaks up on you. Okay, so it's an inherent ambiguity in the language. We don't have the same ambiguity when we're allocating off the heap, because the compiler has enough clues to disambiguate the use. But typically, we prefer to let, when we call a default constructor, to let the compiler do the call for us, instead of giving it some extra hints. Okay, it's just a good habit to get into. Okay, so just a minor annoyance, but nothing too horrible. It's very good for cocktail parties and things like that. Conversation lags.
You're saying the second line better than the first?
I feel that it is, because it's more consistent with what you would do to declare an object, but there's no inherent improvement. It's two fewer characters, and you don't have to type as much. And what else? You're not tempted to type in square brackets. All kinds of things to be said for it. Okay, now here's where Dan Sachs and I disagree totally. Dan Sachs is ordinarily a rational person, as far as I know. But Dan has a problem. He thinks, well, basically his problem is he disagrees with me. And no, actually, because if you knew me better, you'd recognize that I'm always right. And except when I argue with my wife. It's legal to say things like int const extern I. The order of the declaration specifiers is immaterial in a declaration. But everybody expects you to write extern const int I, so you should validate their expectations. A lot of good object-oriented design in general sounds very negative when you look at it from the point of view of human relations, right? I mean, base classes should be totally totalitarian. They should dictate to derived class designers how they must behave. Terrible social policy, but great hierarchy design policy. When you write code that you want somebody to read and understand, you don't want to make these people think. You want to validate their prejudices. You want to take whatever attitudes they're bringing into reading your code and validate them. Why? Because they're going to do it anyway. So in other words, if people expect one thing, you should supply what they're expecting. Especially when it comes to operator overloading. I mean, when you use operator overloading, you're using it entirely to make your code easier to read and understand and maintain. And basically what that comes down to is you're trying to validate the assumptions that people will bring into the situation. So you don't overload plus unless all rational, experienced people will interpret that plus in the same way. Same thing here. Now, I could write something like this. Const int star IP. Okay, what is the type of IP? This is not a trick. It's a pointer to a constant int. Okay, what if I declare an int star const IP? Yeah, now the pointer's const. Don't you hate people who call this a constant pointer? So what did they do in the STL? Does anybody know? When they wanted inside of a container, you ask the container for its iterator type. You can ask for an iterator or a const iterator. Is a const iterator const?
Yes.
No, it's an iterator to a const. Okay. Well, that's another problem. Okay, so this is a constant pointer, and this is a pointer to a const. What about this? Int const star IP. What is the type of IP in the third case? It's a pointer to a const. How will 75% of people read that? Const pointer. What does Dan Sachs say you should do? Yeah, I don't know. I can't figure it out. He claims that he did some tests, and he found out that this was easier to read and understand. I don't know what the population was, though. I mean, if they were... Yeah, you can read it that way. But the question is, where are you coming from? If you're coming from a C background, you might read it as a const pointer. If you're coming from a COBOL background, yeah, maybe. If it's all new to you, maybe it's easier to understand. My experience is this is harder to understand. Dan says this is easier to understand, but most rational people use the first form. Okay. So this is a kind of a standard sequencing storage class, const volatile, qualifier, and then the base type. Try to keep it in that order. Okay, what about static types? This comes up on occasion. No such thing. Static and extern refer to objects, not the types. So a lot of times, people will declare a static class and then terminate the declaration of the class and then declare backup to be a repository. Backup is not a static object. It is an external object. You've just declared an external variable. People will laugh at you behind your back. Okay, so static refers to an object. So repository is static, but backup is not. Okay, so static, any storage class qualifier refers to the object being declared, not to the type being defined. So what should you do? Basically, be simple, be direct, or be modern, use a namespace. Anonymous namespaces are now preferred to the static declaration. Why are they preferred? Namespaces are a nice property, and it's just a good idea to use them, frankly. So these are actually external variables, but they're in an anonymous namespace, so they have the effect of being static. Ah, yes. Maximal munch. Sounds like a pizza party or something. Here's a question. Let's see. A plus 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 B. Is that a legal expression? C will sometimes overload automatics on purpose. These people should be shot. Here's an example. A and B. The storage for these two integers A and B may or may not occupy the same offset within the stack frame. It's entirely up to the compiler. So we can't make any assumptions along that way. Oh, yes. I just want to leave you with two observations. Now, these are very low level, but they've both cost me at least one weekend each of my life. What is the order of evaluation of function arguments? You might ask. It varies. So, what are the two arguments passed to F in this case? I is equal to 12. I have a reference to I. So R is also equal to 12. What values am I passing to F? Well, it could be 12 and 24. What else could it be? 24 and 24. They're both valid. They're both correct. The compiler can do it either way. If you want to fix an evaluation order, you have to explicitly code it. Generally, function arguments should not have side effects. More subtle problem, skip over placement new. This one actually cost me a whole weekend. Here I have an evaluation function. I'm doing some sort of compiler thing here. And I have a node, which could be a plus node or an assignment node, whatever. Some very simple expression evaluator. My eval for plus is what? Well, let's see. If I have a if I have an expression like this, a plus expression, I'll have a syntax tree that has a left-hand side and a right-hand side, and the value of this plus expression is going to be this expression, the value of this expression plus the value of this expression, right? So I can feel free to be recursive, and I'll say, okay, to evaluate a plus node, I'll evaluate the left-hand side, then I'll evaluate the right-hand side, and I'll add the two results together. Now, why did this almost cause a divorce? Which sub-expression is evaluated first? You don't know. Sub-expression evaluation is either implementation defined or undefined. I think it's undefined. So, on the Western Electric 32,000, I first evaluated the left-hand expression, then evaluated the right-hand expression, then added the results. On the HP machine, it was the other way around. Why did this matter? Because if I have A equals 6 plus A, I'm going to get very different results if there's a side effect in the sub-expression. So the only way to do this and guarantee the evaluation order is to first declare a quote-unquote temporary evaluate and then invoke the right-hand side. Now, a lot of people think for some reason that precedence will help them here. And if I say something like F plus G times H, I am somehow fixing the evaluation order of those three function calls. No. The result of G and the result of H will be multiplied first and then added to the result of F. But the order in which these functions are called is not specified. So I could call F, G, and H, or H, G, and F, or some other order. All I'm guaranteed is that the results will be multiplied first, not that the sub-expressions will be evaluated first. Okay. I think I've run out of time. I'd be happy to stay after and talk about Nancy Reagan some more, or tell you exactly why Java is not as bad as I think it is. Dr. Dobbs, Tech Connectors.